Coming up on Ears on Art, a trip north to Toronto, Canada, and a meeting of SNAG, the Society for North American Goldsmiths. Stay tuned. As I just stated, you are tuned in to Ears on Art, a segment of issues and ideas produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio. KCBX serves Southern Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties on California's Central Coast. I am Stephen DeLuque. Co-host Krissa Hewitt traveled to Toronto, Canada to interview Gary Griffin, who received a Lifetime Achievement Award at a meeting of the Society of North American Goldsmiths. To quote the Society's website, the Lifetime Achievement Award is SNAG's highest honor and is presented to individuals who have made significant contributions to the field of metalsmithing. Recipients have distinguished themselves through significant accomplishments in teaching, advocacy, publishing, criticism, and related activities that expand and elevate our field. Mr. Griffin taught at the School for American Craftsmen at Rochester Institute of Technology from 1974 to 1984. He then went to Cranbrook Academy of Art in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, where he was artist-in-residence and head of the metalsmithing department. Gary Griffin is also the recipient of two National Endowment for the Arts grants, and his work has exhibited extensively throughout the world. We now join Krissa for the first half of the interview.
Gary Griffin, hello.
Hello. It's good to be here.
And here, for all of you, is at our annual Society for North American Goldsmiths Conference, which this year is in Toronto. Gary has a very long history, not just with this organization, but with the whole discipline of metalsmithing, and this year was awarded the Lifetime Achievement Award.
And it is a remarkable honor to receive this, especially after knowing about those that have received it previous to me.
It is an impressive list, so congratulations.
Thank you so much.
How did you get into art, let alone metalsmithing?
I come from a family that had artistic inclinations and certainly a love of art. And as a boy, I was regularly taken to museums and to Indian pueblos, and my mother was a antique dealer and an interior designer, so I was very familiar with Louis XIV furniture and 18th century furniture and 19th century Victorian pieces, and so it was something that I think in some ways marinated in, but really only knew it as what my mother did or what my grandmother was interested in. And so let's just say it was not foreign territory. But I didn't really know that it was any different than anybody else's background or raising, how they were raised.
It is interesting when we go to somebody else's house, somebody else's whatever, and go, oh, mine's different.
Yes, exactly. My grandmother Griffin had a summer home in Taos, New Mexico, and from my first birthday through my 17th birthday, I spent every summer with her, which included all of her friends who were painters in the Taos area and mover and shakers of various sorts. And I basically knew what they did, but I really only knew them as my grandmother's friends and didn't really realize until much later what a really remarkable and unusual experience I had had.
Were they involving you in creating, or was it mostly just enjoying or observing what they were doing?
Well, my mother encouraged my grandmother to allow me to go to a studio in two different cases. One was with a ceramic artist, and I would go there once a week for a couple of hours and make some things or attempt to make some things. But the thing I remember the most was one summer I went the once a week, couple of hours, mm-hmm. to a colonial wood, Hispanic wood carver's studio. And I actually ended up with a chair. I think I was 13 years old. And of course, he helped me with all the joinery, but he insisted that I do the carving. He would lay it out. And so I learned carving rosettes and some of the aesthetic sensibilities of his work. I still have the chair.
Oh, good.
Yes, yes. So those kinds of experiences were very important in the sense that I like to make things and always did. And my mother provided me with a little work space in the garage, which most often included airplane models and things like that. But every once in a while, I'd get a crazy idea and try and build something. And sometimes it worked out to some degree, and sometimes it didn't. But my first experience with metal was very frustrating because it was far more difficult than wood, and you needed a very different tool vocabulary and skill set, and then tools, very different tools and things. Everything I had was either a wood saw or plane or something that was made for woodworking, and it was not fit for metal.
How did that metal experience come to happen?
There was a point where I decided that I wanted to learn to weld, and I actually went to a junior college trade program for a year. It was a two-year program, and we welded 4 hours a day, and then I would take other classes in the afternoon. Basically, when I left there, I wasn't a certified welder, but I was capable of getting a job as a welder. I received a job at Starkist Foods in their maintenance welding department. The maintenance departments of places like that are, they have a full machine shop. They've got everything to fix whatever breaks down in the cannery. That's where I learned a lot of machining skills, increased my welding skills, and I did that throughout college as a means of earning money.
And where was that?
That was in Long Beach, California.
Okay, somehow I didn't think tuna was necessarily in New Mexico, but...
No, it was in Long Beach, California. Well, they were canning fish on Terminal Island in the Long Beach Harbor at that point. That doesn't exist anymore.
And you were at Long Beach State?
I then went to Long Beach State College and enrolled in the Industrial Arts Program, which really was a place for training secondary teachers, and I liked that area because it was really a tool-based skill set place. But as I was proceeding through, I realized there's no design down here. They don't take that into consideration. They give you a set of plans and you make something. And I just felt something was missing. And at that point, I declared a dual major and took classes in the art department and in the industrial arts department. And it was in the art department that I found the crafts areas and then found metalsmithing. And I well remember that once I entered the art department and started taking two- and three-dimensional design, that there would be, commonly, there would be displays in the hallway of work of students. And when I saw the work that the metalsmithing program was putting out, and I saw teapots and raised vessels and all this jewelry, I just couldn't believe that someone actually made it, and thought, I need to inquire about that. So when I became eligible for those kinds of classes, I immediately enrolled, and the program was a rigorous one. It was very skill-based initially, along with design, and so they were giving you skill sets as well as design problems, and it fascinated me, it interested me, engaged me, and I just worked at it all the time. I loved it. Of course, that one thing led to another, and went through what I think was a really large arsenal of techniques and historical goldsmithing and silversmithing and even blacksmithing. And then I left and taught school for a couple of years in the public schools in Long Beach, but we knew that I would go to graduate school. And we took a trip across the country, visited a number of schools that we were interested in, and then in the end chose one, which I suppose was risky business.
And this was?
It was Tyler School of Art with Stanley Lexen. I was on the West Coast, and the work on the East Coast was so advanced and so adventurous. And I thought, this is what one should do. If you see something you admire, you should go for it and get over there and be with those people and soak it up. So I did.
Your story about seeing the displays in the hallways and stuff, I am a graduate of Cal State Northridge, and it was a similar experience of taking a summer school class in ceramics between kind of high school and starting college. And there was this small little case that had some jewelry in it. I stuck that in the back of my head, and I went off to UC Davis for 2 years and then transferred and wasn't able to get into the art classes right away because they were so full. And then finally landed the one, and then my first instructor brought some of his work to school one day, and one of them was this little silver box. And I went, you can teach me how to make a box.
Yeah.
And I was hooked.
Yes.
And I can really identify with that sense of, whoa, you can do that?
Yes, exactly. And I think even today, to see a flat sheet become a volume, that suspends belief. And no matter how it's done, whether it's pressed or formed by hand or spun on a lathe, when you see the metal actually moving, and most people's experience with metal in terms of it changing form is when they wreck their car. And you see that mess in front of you, and you can't imagine how that can be changed or corrected. And that the material actually has plasticity is beyond most people's comprehension.
Well, Charles Luton Brain talks about copper squirting.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
It was just this wonderful image, but he's right, and we don't think of it that way even when we've been working with it a lot. That's not an adjective that gets put out there.
Precisely, and it's one of the things that really attracted me or continued to attract me about metal in particular was that as one moves through undergraduate experience and you're sampling a lot of things, you begin to establish what some people might call fit. And there's a point where there's a particular medium that seems to fit whatever your sensibilities are. And a comparison would be, it always bothered me that clay in particular was not willing to stay where I wanted to put it. And so, in other words, the metal required a very different skill set. But I like the fact that if I bent it, and I bent it in the place that I wanted to, that it was going to stay there. And even though, you know, there's a little bit of elasticity and it may spring back a bit, I knew how to deal with that. But I knew it would be there and that it wasn't going to slump over or decide that because of certain gravitational forces that it was unwilling to do what I asked of it. And that appealed to me.
If you have just tuned in, you are enjoying the first of a two-part interview with the Society of North American Goldsmiths Lifetime Achievement Award winner for 2013, Gary Griffin. This program is Ears on Art, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio KCBX on California's Central Coast. We now join co-host Krissa Hewitt and Gary Griffin discussing the various attributes and challenges of the different materials.
Again, I can identify with that one a lot because I was in the early stages, of course, learning how to throw on the wheel, and that was all very exciting, and I loved it at first, and then all of a sudden it was, wait a minute, Right. It's controlling me a lot more than I seem to be able to control it.
Right.
Now I use clay for its spontaneity.
Mm-hmm.
And if it takes more than half an hour to work a piece, that's too long.
Right. Precisely. I think that's one of the things that that even though metal can be appear to be very gestural and very spontaneous, that in effect that's what it can represent, but that's not actually how it got there. It was a far more planned process, and one that was required a certain number of steps to get there. It's a different kind of response. I think there's a point, though, that once one really develops some level of expertise or fit, whatever you want to call it, that it doesn't seem cumbersome anymore. You just know that it takes time. And one of the things I've always really liked about the material is that it can exist in different states of matter. It can be a solid or it can be a liquid. So in other words, you can mold things and cast into it. You can also subtract, and you can displace, which is a really unusual characteristic. In other words, you can take a cube of material and you can hammer it into a sheet, or you can draw it into wire. So in other words, you can completely displace the same amount of material. That's a very unusual characteristic.
It is. Talk about the similarities and differences as you've worked initially with welding and then moving into precious and semi-precious metals and back and forth.
I like the idea that there's the periodic chart, basically, and the metals are pretty most of it. And there's this vast array of materials, precious, base metals, and they all have very interesting characteristics and may be useful for different kinds of operations. I know that when I did work with gold, that it amazed me at how malleable it was and how far it could be extended out of a half an ounce of gold, how much territory you could cover. And of course, there's so many historical examples. Every culture had used this material in one form or another and spread it all over their masks and their bodies and everything else, and in some cases their buildings. The thing that really, I think in some ways, allowed me a lot of territory to move from was I was always interested in technique and never really ashamed to be curious technically. I'm a technical geek, but I'm also very interested in the intellectual side of it and the plastic and the poetic side. But when new things came along or new opportunities in terms of technical interests, I always followed them. And so hammering is hammering. There obviously is a different way to handle a piece of silver than there is a piece of steel, but it's still hammering. And I mean, I have racks of hammers you just wouldn't believe, and they're segregated. You know, these are for over here and these are for over here. They don't really cross over into different metals. You know, if you're dealing with polished hammers, you don't want to be hammering a piece of hot steel with the scale on it. But the plasticity is comparable in materials, and it's just sometimes the material has to be hot and sometimes it has to be cold. And an example would be if you hammer sterling silver, it hardens as you hammer it. But if you hammer pewter, it softens. And it you know, there are inherent characteristics in these metals once you adjust for that, but you're still hammering.
Even in the welding, which you were doing early on, as compared to what we call soldering in the metalsmithing world, which is it more legally brazing than soldering by definition?
Yes,
but anyway, those differences for you, I mean, was it hard to make some of that adjustment?
Well, I think it depends on how you look at it. But if you look at it as joining, and that you take two pieces of metal and you join them together, they're different technically, but they're still joining. And I think the major difference is that the welding technique is actually a fusion. So you take two pieces of material and you fuse them together, so that joint is essentially the same material. Whereas in brazing, it would be more comparable to adhesion. In other words, it would be comparable to a bond, an adhesive bond, and it could be an excellent one. For example, when you happen to glue your fingers together with super glue, you've got a bond that's really a problem. But it's different than when your skin grows back together, which is comparable to fusion. So the idea of joining, I knew things could be joined, and I think that soldering in particular is immensely challenging. I can give you an example. If you are soldering sterling silver all day, and you're dealing with solder that melts in the territory of 1300 degrees, and then you decide you're going to solder platinum, well, you're in a different territory altogether because you've got to go up to 2000 degrees. That is a big move. And usually when you go back to sterling, then you melt everything because it's at 1300. And so there's an adjustment, and that's really one of the wonderful things about craft is that it's a physical and a very much a body experience. In other words, you have a torch, you have this material, and you're looking at what's happening, you're smelling what's happening, you're feeling heat, you're looking for any kinds of signs for this solder to begin to flow. And you not only have to keep your eyes on that little piece of solder, but you have to know where the extended flame of the torch is, because usually beginners, they will be so focused on that solder line that the envelope of the flame will melt another end of the piece. And so there's a real sophistication in the vision that develops, in the hand-eye coordination. It's craft, and is a really remarkable experience, and something that's it's actually unusual to know about it.
Use of all of our senses, and that we're often thinking that we're only involved with one or something. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, I just have to look at this. But what are you looking at? You're looking at color. You're looking at sure. flux consistency. You're looking at all sorts of things, and you better be paying attention.
That's right. You better be paying attention. Yeah, and I think it's true of a lot of the routines or the processes we go through. When you're buffing, you can really destroy something. Or even if you're using a belt grinder, whatever tool it is or whatever means of subtraction, you have to be able to sense when it's cutting. Because if it's not cutting, there's going to be a problem. You're going to roll an edge or lose a piece or something. And what I think is remarkable about that is that somehow through the ends of your fingers and in combination with your eyes, you know when something is happening or not. It could be the spark that comes off and you look at it and it's not right. That's a very physical and, I suppose, even poetic experience.
Somehow it gets more poetic all the time, I think, as I, you know, maybe I just get more tuned into it, but it's also as I attempt to explain a process to somebody who's wanting to learn it, and then you're recognizing all this wealth of years of doing something.
Right.
And how do I translate that?
Well, I think the first part of that is you have to restrain yourself because, you know, after so many years of experiencing something, one becomes aware that there are developmental cycles and and of course you can readily remember your own, that you too broke saw blades and you too melted things. And so this person that may be asking questions of you regarding these processes is most likely at an earlier stage, and you don't want to unload your wagon on them.
No.
You know, you start out with something really simple, really basic and limited, so that they have a one thing that they can concentrate on. And then once they start to get a better sense of that, then you can add something else. But I think restraint early on is really, really important.
It's a fascinating challenge,
exactly.
I find, because, yes, I certainly remember melting things. I still break saw blades. I still melt things. And yet, at the same time, there's an awful lot that is now second nature that I don't really remember that shift.
Precisely. It becomes intuitive. Not unlike driving a car, how many people actually think or identify that they're putting on the brake or pushing on the gas, or for that matter, where they're going? How often are we going down the highway and then suddenly we turn and we realize, well, we're not going home, we're going here, we're going to the market. In other words, we go into remote, which is a deep level of intuition. And I think that any of these processes we're in as we advance become very intuitive, whether it's annealing something or whether it's even selecting materials. You know what to look for, and you are being cautious about certain things that someone less experienced would overlook.
Co-host Krista Hewitt and I would like to thank today's guest, Gary Griffin, the recipient of the Society of North American Goldsmiths Lifetime Achievement Award for 2013. We will continue our discussion with Mr. Griffin on next week's program. But if you would like, you may find out more information about SNAG and Gary's award and work at the website snagmetalsmith.org. In an unusual collaborative exhibit at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art is the work of photographer John Divola in a show titled As Far As I Could Get. This is the first overarching presentation of Divola's work and is a collaboration between the Santa Barbara Museum of Art with concurrent exhibitions at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art and the Pomona College Museum of Art. Mr. Divola's exhibit runs until January 12, 2014 at SBMA. The museum is open Tuesday through Sunday from 11 a.m. until 5 p.m., and there is a charge for admission for non-members. Their website is sbmuseart.org, and the museum is located at 1130 State Street in downtown Santa Barbara. This has been a presentation of Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced and recorded at the studios of listener-supported public radio KCBX, serving the California Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. I am Stephen DeLuque. Please join us next week as Krista Hewitt returns to Toronto, Canada, to continue her conversation with Gary Griffin.